Thank you for joining me. This is the Bold Lines podcast, and I am your host, Travis Thompson. Today, we're going to be talking about healing the heart of addiction through attachment. This episode is going to comprise of a few different things. The first is to go ahead and define what we're talking about, so that way we know what's going on. If you need more information, you can go back to previous episodes. There you can find how I've defined addiction through different lenses. Today we're going to be talking about attachment theory, how it applies to addiction, and how we can find healing and recovery. I'm going to go over some of the basics of attachment theory again for those that need a refresher, or maybe for those that are just tuning in for the first time. In attachment theory, the basic concern of every individual are the relationships that they get growing up. How are they able to love someone? How are they able to make meaningful purpose out of their actions? What is it that they do to help establish connection? In attachment theory, there are four basic needs that have to be met. The first is a secure base. This is a way that people find grounding where they launch from. This is what helps them interpret the world around them. The second is a safe haven. The safe haven is the place that you run to when things are overwhelming and you're not quite sure how to handle it. It's where you go when you feel overwhelmed. The third is proximity maintenance. Proximity maintenance is how we mitigate distance. This is how we check in with people or make sure that we stay in some level of continued contact. And the final, the fourth one, is separation distress. Now, separation distress is a little bit different from proximity maintenance. Separation distress is how we deal with the distance emotionally. When we can't connect to this person or to the people that help us feel safe, how do we deal with the turmoil? Okay, so we have the four basic needs. There are also the three basic attachment styles that you need to know. The first of these is secure attachment. Secure attachment means that when a child or an adolescent, and also an adult, which we'll talk more about later today, when they feel connected to someone and that person leaves and comes back, they feel a fluid, loving connection. There's not a concern about how that person will respond. It's generally speaking a positive experience without really any drawbacks. It feels open and relaxed. The second version of this is insecure, anxious attachment. Now, this attachment is marked by a caregiver, a friend, or a loved one having inconsistent responses to you or to a small child. Now, these inconsistent responses create a sense of anxiety or insecurity because the child or even yourself isn't quite sure what response you're going to get. And so in an effort to try to make sense of that or to try to control it to some degree, we get high levels of emotion to try to enforce a sense of connection. The third category is insecure avoidant attachment. This is different from insecure anxious attachment in the sense that insecure avoidant children, friends, or adults, when there is distance, they don't really care all that much. And when that person returns, they don't seem to care all that much either. They've created this sense of internal safety, not because they feel so confident, but because the world has been so inconsistently caring that they've learned not to trust it. There is a fourth category called disorganized. I wouldn't worry about that one too much. It's more just how someone doesn't quite fit into one of the categories. Usually they sort themselves out. Okay, so here's where this is going to start to get interesting. We know the basic needs that people have, and we know the ways that they interact with others. Where we're going to find a lot of good ground to work from today is how we connect to attachment figures. Now, these attachment figures change over time. I've talked about the four basic needs and attachment styles in children mostly, but this also happens with friends and with a significant other, and that's the important thing here. All people start with an attachment style that is directly connected to their parents and caregivers. Now, these connections are incredibly important because they create our basic understanding of attachment and connection and love. those connections are incredibly important. And because they're the basic understanding of everything, they color the way we see everything else in the world. Now, our parents are our superheroes. They're the ones who can do no wrong. You know, the classic version of this is, my dad can beat up your dad. Something silly like that that kids argue about. But even a joke like that provides useful insight for us as therapists or just as regular people to understand where kids are getting their safety from, where they're getting their attachment information. As kids get a little bit older, those attachment figures move from parents to friends. You could see this really obviously in grade school when all of a sudden children seem to care less about what their parents think and more about what their friends think. This gets kind of hairy because, you know, kids aren't always the best source of information. But developmentally, this is incredibly important. As children detach from parents in a general way, they start to attach to their peers. Now, they shouldn't be 100% detached. Please don't hear that. But it is important for kids to start to let go of some of those parental attachments to socially connect with those around them. It's important and very healthy. After some time with friends, and particularly a little after puberty, those relationships move from high importance on friends and to a significant other. This is when kids start to date. Now, some kids date earlier than others, and it gets really complicated. However, for attachment, what we're really concerned about is where people are finding information and safety. And it becomes pretty obvious when someone moves from an attachment primarily with friends into a significant other, because then all of a sudden, they don't care as much of what their friends think. They're not as concerned with what their friends are doing. They're more concerned about what their partner is doing or thinking. Of course, this can be well overdone, but it does give us a progression over time. So we know how this works, and we know the basic attachment figures that we use. Where does addiction fit into all of this? Because all of this is well and good and can be very useful, but what if there were particular patterns that addicts tended to use? What if there was a way to understand the precursors to addiction through attachment? Well, this is my podcast, and I'm not going to pose a question I probably don't have an answer to. So, here we go. Almost every single addict I have ever worked with has an insecure, anxious attachment. With this insecure, anxious attachment style that I see in my office, I start to get curious. How did they get there? What was it that brought them to the point of being insecurely attached with everyone around them? What was it that gave them this insecure or unsure expectation of what to have? How they interact with loved ones, significant others, their children, or whoever else? Remember, insecure, anxious attachment means that someone is unsure about relational outcomes. The emotions can move back and forth. The perceived connection can move back and forth. In little kids, they become incredibly overwhelmed, and they start to try to enforce relationship to their parents. Now, how do they do that? Well, they'll hit them or scream at them or yell at them. But let's take this one step further. Let's move up the chain. So we move from parents to friends. And that insecure, anxious child then is unsure about friendships and how to handle them. They become, well, for lack of a better word, anxious about how to engage with their peers. They become unable to be secure and have a solid understanding. And so they learn to enforce relationships with peers, either subtly or not so subtly. And let me give you some examples of this. It's easy to have friends when there's something that's engaging. If you're the one that brings the beer, all of a sudden you have a bunch of friends. Or maybe let's take something not so subtle. It's easy to keep people around if they feel bad for you or they feel like they should support you. It's not always a great thing to realize in therapy, but it's better that you realize it now than later. As this moves to working with a significant other, it becomes really obvious that that insecure attachment and that uncertainty of outcomes enforces the way that someone with an insecure, anxious attachment interacts. If you're not quite sure whether a significant other is going to stick around or not, it can be really easy to make grand gestures. One of the big jokes that I always talk about in the therapy and I talk about outside of it is the trend of a promposal. And if you haven't heard of that, consider yourself blessed, because the basic idea is you can't invite anyone to prom anymore. It has to be this whole ordeal, which is odd considering it's a one-night event. However, that is a great example of enforcing connection or relationship. How can you say no to that? Outside of high school, what about a relationship dynamic where one person is desperately needed? If one person is the quote-unquote project, it's really hard to say no to a project that loves you and needs you. On the other hand, if you are the one who fixes the projects, man, it's pretty straightforward to know that they're not going anywhere. And you can end up supporting this dysfunctional behavior because it keeps them around. You can enforce relationship. Here's the crazy thing about insecure, anxious attachments in addiction is that that connection to significant other doesn't stay there. You see, I believe that when it comes to addiction and attachment, addicts treat their substance of choice as a relationship. It's their way to attach to something, to make sense of the world. It's like a relationship. I've explained this dynamic to many spouses of those in addiction, and a light bulb always goes off. My goodness, that's what it is. It's felt like they were cheating on me, but it hasn't been with a person. Well, I usually then go to explain, and let's go back to our four basic needs. If you haven't experienced addiction, this might be enlightening. If you have, or you've cared for someone that has had issues in addiction, it's going to become immediately obvious that this is what's going on. So let's start with the secure base. And we'll use alcohol because that's just the easy one to go with. If we were to assume that someone in addiction has a relationship with alcohol, what that would look like from an attachment perspective is they would start to see alcohol as a way to make sense of the world. They would view their world through the lens of alcohol. Now, does that mean they're looking for a shot in their wife's eyes? No. But what it does mean is that as they think about their day, as they start to understand or plan what's going to happen, they use alcohol to mitigate that. When can they have a drink? How do they have it? How much can they have? Man, people are being really mean to me. Gosh, alcohol's not that big of a deal. It's kind of like they're describing an abusive or unhealthy partner. The safe haven is really easy. When they're stressed and overwhelmed, they go drink. That's the one that everybody's got. Now, let's think of proximity maintenance. If you've ever lived with an alcoholic, one of the things that you probably found interesting at first and sad later on is just how close they would keep alcohol to them. They would be upset if someone moved it or if the fridge was empty. They would make sure that there was always a can or a bottle around them. This is a way to help deal with the proximity or the distance from something. Separation distress is actually really fascinating in addiction, particularly with alcoholism, because once there's distance, somebody gets a craving or an urge and they don't have anything around them, they panic, almost as if their caregiver has abandoned them or their significant other isn't responding. You know, it's even more fascinating. They can have these biological responses. They can start to shake and their heart starts racing and they get all of the signs of withdrawal until they put those keys in the ignition and are on their way to the liquor store. And then all of a sudden, the anxiety goes away. This is one of my favorite arguments against the whole addiction is a disease thing, because I've never heard of a disease that gets cured, at least in short term, by turning on the ignition of a car. If you followed with all of those translations of addiction and attachment, you can start to understand why someone might feel loved. They might feel safe in their addiction. When I work with someone in recovery, I don't argue that they shouldn't feel safe or they shouldn't feel loved. I only argue that that love and safety is synthetic, because over time, one, they know it doesn't work. They're aware that they have an abusive partner. But this abusive partner has isolated them from other forms of attachment. If you've known someone or you have been someone in an emotionally abusive relationship, it's kind of the same thing. You would have been isolated from the people that care about you, either explicitly or sometimes unconsciously done, but it happened. And those in addiction, particularly the ones that are in the more severe versions of it, experience the same thing, where now the only version of safety they have left is synthetic, and it isolates them. When they only have one option left, people get desperate. They get desperate to protect it, even when they know it's not logical. You see this all the time outside of addiction, in those unhealthy relationships where they know things aren't good, but they feel good sometimes, and there's nowhere else to go. So in therapy, I don't tell people that alcohol didn't make them feel better, because it did. That's the whole point. It has very little to do with brain chemicals and more to do about feeling safe in a way that the world makes sense. Now, what does healthy recovery look like? Well, first, you have to acknowledge that this is an abusive, unhealthy relationship. This isn't something you can just walk back into and make sense of. It's one of the greatest arguments against this whole moderate drinking that happens afterward. Because if we were to translate it into that unhealthy or abusive relationship, it's, well, I know I was in a relationship with her, and it was awful, so bad, but I just want to hang out with her now and again. If you look at it like that, you sound crazy. Why would you go back? It was never good. You just are thinking back with rose-colored lenses. It doesn't work that way. But here's the other thing that I forgot to mention earlier, but is incredibly important. That unhealthy partner will always, always, always take you back. No matter how many times you screw up, no matter how many people isolate you, alcohol in this instance will always take you back. There will never be a time when it will leave you or tell you you can't stop by. The only thing that would keep you from it is money. And if you can stand on the side of the road and hold your hand out, alcohol will never leave you. When you put it like that, it starts to sound real grim. But that's the place that people can get to. Maybe not everybody ends up on the side of the road, but a lot of people end up isolating from everyone around them. In order to not get there, the solution isn't to provide medication that keeps them from using or drinking again. Although it can be helpful in some instances, it doesn't actually fix the problem. What needs to happen instead are for people in addiction early recovery to accept emotional and relational risk from people that care. This means that you can't overdo emotion or relationship in order to enforce connection. You have to be able to sit on your hands and wait for a second. Let other people think. Other people get to decide how they respond to you. It doesn't matter how many times you've relapsed. They can still say no. It doesn't matter if you've been clean for 3 years and then all of a sudden you screw up again or you make a slip. You don't get to enforce that attachment. It's no longer secure if you're making it happen or you're guilting someone into it. Because if you enforce it, it's not secure. It's insecure and anxious. Once you can accept emotional and relational risk, you can start to get continued feedback from people. You get open feedback that's real and meaningful and not just something to kind of make you feel a little bit better. You're not going to get patted on the head or made to feel small because then you can hear hard things. If you want to be someone who has secure relationships, secure attachments, and not need drugs or alcohol or whatever addiction anymore, you need to be an adult. I know that sounds like a weird place to get to the closing of this podcast episode, but quite honestly, everybody in addiction that I have seen has a childlike or teenage-like response to relationships around them. Be an adult. Grow up. Know that there's risk involved. Know that people can decide to be around you or not, and you can still be okay. Yes, things might be awful. Yes, things might suck. And yes, people might leave you. However, when you're an adult, it might seem risky, but it's always way more worth it. Because in addiction, attachment is never secure. It's always there. It will never leave you. But it doesn't actually make you fulfilled. This synthetic connection, this synthetic love with a lover who is emotionally abusive will never take you anywhere. Don't believe the lie that there's no one else who can care for you. If you're willing to take the risk to slow down, to sit on your hands and listen, what's likely to happen is the people who care about you will need to yell. That's pretty straightforward. Why would they yell? Is it because they hate you? No, because they're trying to treat you like an equal. They're trying to treat you like an adult that they care about. And once they get done with that, chances are they're not going to continue. They're going to care for you. So grow up. Be an adult. Know that your attachments cannot be based on feelings and enforced connection. If you want to find that healing, you have to take risk. Reasonable risk, obviously, but you have to be able to go for a secure connection and allow others to do the same, not feel like they're restricted or they have to do it or you're going to relapse. They do it because they love you and they want to, not because they feel bad for you. Thank you for listening today. I hope you got something that would be useful for you. If you feel the need, you can leave something in the tip jar to pay for the production of these episodes. If not, I hope that you can share this episode with others or you can subscribe to the podcast to hear more.